Chapter 23.
Though the bishop had buried his heathen youth better than had Theobrand, he could not help enjoying the story as he told it, relishing the blood and blows and trickery to a degree that would have called forth his pious rebuke had he observed it in others. He seemed to forget that what he was relating might be a death sentence to himself and his listener. If Olaf had left the future of his throne to God, he said, all would have gone well with him and his throne too, for God would have seen to it that the best possible king would always be sitting upon it. But Olaf would have it sat on only by someone of his own blood, and to that end began looking about for a wife to breed him a son. The king of Denmark offered him his sister, but Olaf called her a heathen bitch, and that set the Danes against him. The king of Sweden offered him his daughter, but Olaf said she was too ugly to rouse a love lust in any but horses, which the Swedes are known to sacrifice before their idols, and that set the Swedes against him. Many Norsemen were already against him, under the leadership of Earl Eric, son of Hakon, whom Olaf drove to his death under the pigsty. The Earl and the two kings put their three fleets together, the better to fight him, and their three heads together, the better to trick him. Just before he sailed, he was indeed wed to a Christian maid named Thyr, but she tried to kill him with a bodkin on their wedding night, and it turned out that her Christianity was a fraud and she was the daughter of a slain bonder, trying to avenge her father. Olaf had her head cut off and sailed for Iceland. I think an Iceland woman might have been his queen if he'd ever got here. King Olaf's fleet was the greatest that ever sailed the ocean. It filled the whole harbor of Nidaros, the ships lying so close together that a man could walk from shore to shore with no trouble beyond climbing over the rails. The largest but two was the crane. The largest but one was the little serpent. And the largest of all was the long serpent, which rose like a mountain amid hills. If Olaf has done nothing else for Norway, he has left it the sight of that fleet, which will be described from father to son as long as men have eyes and the memory of what they saw with them in Nidaros Harbor. Now that there is no longer any King Olaf to hear us or to have our words told him by spies, we may say without endangering our poor skins that this fleet was largely the child of his vanity. He had it in his mind to be the greatest king who ever lived on earth, rivaling Charlemagne and Constantine, whose example, it seems, had filled his heart not only with God, but, alas, with envy, too. But besides serving his vanity, he had a clear and crafty purpose in building that mighty fleet, over and above the avowed aim of celebrating his entry into Iceland. This island was to have been the third jewel he would add to the crown of Norway, not the first. He meant, after setting sail, to alter his course suddenly, head for Skagerrak, and fall by surprise upon the Danes and Swedes in turn. The name by which he wanted to be known was Olaf, King of all the North by the grace of God. I fear that the word Olaf was the part of it he valued the most. His three biggest ships, and the pride he took in them, were what wrecked his plan. The crane, the little serpent, and the long serpent were the undoing of Olaf as the Tower of Babel was of its builders. They sailed last in the immense line for the greater fear such a culmination would evoke in the beholder. The fleet sailed in a straight line down the coast, but these three, needing deeper water, had to take a longer way, around the island of Svold, counting on their greater number of oarsmen to help them catch up with the others further on. It was on this roundabout course that Olaf's enemies reckoned, knowing the northern waters as well as he did. They lay in wait for him in a cove that he would have to pass, ready to pounce upon his three ships with their three fleets. I was on my own ship, which is amongst those that went on straight ahead. A day later, when we began wondering why the crane and the two serpents had not rejoined us, we turned back to look for them and learned what had happened. Here is what was told to me by a man we picked out of the water. While the Earl and the two kings kept watch on a high point of land, a horseman came galloping to them from the other side of Svold and told them they'd made a mistake and their prey had escaped them. Olaf's entire fleet had sailed by, he said, with hundreds of ships so huge that he could not tell which were the three they sought. But they were among them, certainly, and had evidently found it possible, after all, to steer safely through the inner waters. When the two kings heard that, they turned on Earl Eric, accusing him of treachery, for the plan was his that they had followed, as he was the one who had seen the three great ships and was sure they needed the deeper water. "We see now," said King Svein Forkbeard the Dane, "that Earl Eric fears Olaf and does not dare avenge his father's death. The Swedish king, whose name is Olaf too, Fat Olaf, his men call him to mark him from the other," added his taunt. "It shall be sung in every country in the world," he said, "that Hakon's son made us sit here with all our host like frogs in a pond, because he feared he might meet his father's fate." Earl Eric became enraged at this and answered them, "The Danes and Swedes are very brave because no enemy is near. I suggest we draw lots now, while you are still so full of heroism, to see who attacks the long serpent, for when you see it, you will not be so eager." They did as he proposed, more in scorn than any other way, and it was determined that the Dane should attack first, the Swede second, and Earl Eric third, if indeed by then the long serpent was still afloat. Just as they settled this, an immense ship came into sight, larger than any they had ever seen, and larger than any the messenger had seen on the other side of the island. Instantly, the two kings admitted that Earl Eric had spoken the truth, and asked his pardon for their affront. "The long serpent is even greater and grander than I thought it would be," said Svein. "It is worthy to be the bearer of our great enemy," said Fat Olaf. They wanted to begin the attack, but Earl Eric laughed at them. "The ship you see is the Crane," he said. They doubted his word and were ready to believe he was the coward they'd thought him, and that he was merely finding a new excuse for avoiding battle. But a moment later, they saw an even larger ship following the first. It was only the Little Serpent, yet they made their same mistake once more, and again Eric laughed at them scornfully. Then fright suddenly seized them, and it was the Earl's turn to taunt them, for a third ship appeared around the point, far larger than the first two combined, so immense that long after the prow had glided into view, they were still waiting to see the stern. It was magnificent in its design, and so covered with ornament that the gleam of the sun upon it dazzled them, so that they found it hard to continue looking at it, while its reflection set the waves aglow and made it seem that another great golden ship were swimming below it. At its stem and stern were the mighty head and tail of the giant snake that gave this greatest of ships its name. "Now," said Earl Eric, "you are seeing the Long Serpent." Their three fleets were so hidden by the headland that the Crane and the Little Serpent saw them before King Olaf could. The first two ships stopped rowing and waited for their king. He called across the water to ask why they waited. They shouted to him that their enemies were facing them in great force and urged him to put about and row full speed for safety. To that, King Olaf answered, "Lower the sails and put out the oars to stop the ship. I will die before I run. Tie our three ships together, side by side. We fight." This Olaf was a man, my brother, such as we have seldom seen. all things that were loved and admired by the heathen, he did better than any, and did it against the heathen. His orders were obeyed. The ships were lashed together, with the long serpent in the middle. At first, the splicing was done so that its stern extended beyond the other two, but Olaf would not have it so. "I will be first in battle, not last," he said. The commander of the stem, Ulf Redbeard, grumbled at this, saying there was a difference between courage and folly, and that they could fight better if the three stems were side by side. Olaf heard this and said angrily, "I did not know I had a coward aboard," and aimed an arrow at Ulf. But Ulf was as brave as any man and replied, "Aim at your enemies. Before this day is ended, you will not think you have too many men of your own." Olaf did not shoot the arrow. Olaf took his place on the highest deck. He wore a gilded helmet and carried a gilded shield, and over his mail he wore a kirtle of red silk. He wanted to be recognized by the enemy, so that the hardest fighting would come in his direction. Like his great fleet, this was no mere vanity. His example made each of his men a berserk. They bit their shields and shouted to let the fight begin. "Whose standard is that that floats above the nearest fleet?" Olaf asked. "It's the Danish king, Sveen," was the answer. "We will tie his forked beard in a knot," said Olaf. Then he asked whose was the second fleet that waited some distance behind. "That is fat Olaf, the Swede," a man told him. "He shall eat a supper of fish tonight," said Olaf. But when he asked about the third fleet and was told it was commanded by Hakon's son Eric, he made no jibe, but said, "They will give us the hardest fight, for they are Norsemen." The war horns blew, the war cry rose from both sides, and the Battle of Svold began. It happened as Olaf had said it would. First, Sveen attacked with 60 Danish ships, but his great numbers did not win for him. The three ships of Olaf stood higher out of the water than any of the Danes had, and showered arrows and darts upon them, which they did their best to return, but their best was not good enough. So much blood poured over the Danish decks and down their sides that it is said they looked as if they had been newly painted red. At last the Danes had had their fill of this vulture's feast and withdrew, leaving their allies to carry on the fight while they bound their wounds and got fresh men from shore. But such of their arrows as had found their marks has done great harm, for Olaf could less well afford his losses than his many foes could theirs. Olaf was right, too, in his guess about how the fight with the Swedes would turn out, though he found it harder to prove. Fat Olaf and his men used grappling hooks and tried to board the Norse ships, and it cost hard fighting and many deaths to beat them off. It was swords and axes this time, and those who were strong and clever enough to split a man into two even halves had a chance to show their skill. A great surprise was the courage of Fat Olaf. He was intent on fighting it out, sword against sword, with his namesake, and cut a path to him that brought them face to face. Then the two Olafs met in what everyone agreed was the fiercest fight of all, and they showed such hatred of each other and such recklessness in satisfying it that for a while the rest of the battle ceased, while all watched these two. Fat Olaf was in his berserk fury and screamed that there should be only one Olaf, so that neither would need be called fat. His best weapon was the same mass of flesh that made him rage so. He hurled himself at his foeman and pressed him back against the rail by his very bulk. He had his sword to Olaf's ribs, and everyone thought to see it rammed home when Olaf struck him a blow with his mailed elbow that sent him staggering back like a butchered ox. Olaf followed him before he could regain his balance, picked him up, fat and all, as if plucking a flower from meadow, and tossed him over the rail back into his own ship, onto which he fell with such a crash that all thought it would sink. This so encouraged the Norsemen and so disheartened the Swedes that the decks of the three Norse ships were soon cleared and the invaders sent scurrying after their Danish friends. It was Olaf's misfortune that his guest was also right about what would happen when they fought Earl Eric and his Norsemen. The Earl's ship was named the Beard, because it had a cluster of iron spikes projecting from its prow, which indeed resembled a great black beard. These spikes had points for ramming, and sharp edges too, which could cut through ropes and rigging when driven against another vessel. When, as had been agreed upon, he entered the fight after the defeat of the Danes and Swedes, his first deed was to drive the Beard between the Long Serpent and the Little Serpent, cutting the ropes by which the two ships were held together, and setting the smaller one adrift. The Earl then steered the Beard around to the other side of the Long Serpent and cut the crane loose from it in the same manner. The two smaller vessels were at once surrounded by dozens of enemy ships from all three fleets and were boarded, this time successfully, for it was no longer possible for men to jump down to their aid from the higher deck of the Long Serpent. It is said that King Olaf's warriors on the Long Serpent grew so furious that they tried to leap across the water to their comrades' aid, as if their very rage could carry them like wings. Many were drowned in this manner, being carried to the bottom by the weight of their mail and by their weapons, of which they would not let go. Then the Long Serpent and the men on it, who yet remained alive, were all that King Olaf had left to keep him on his throne. But these were a mighty force, for Olaf said to them, "We need 100 times as many men as we have to win this fight, so each of us must become the equal of 100. They heeded what he said and very nearly did it. Among the best was Einar Shieldcleaver, the great bowman. As the Beard turned toward the Long Serpent, he shot at Earl Eric, who was sheltered by his men behind a wall of shields, keeping such a stream of arrows in the air that the Earl dared not step forth, but was a prisoner where he crouched. He had, aboard with him, a group of Laplanders, famous for their marksmanship, though none of them was the equal to Einar. They stood with their mouths open, marveling at his skill, until the Earl screamed at them, "Stop gaping at that bowman and shoot him!" Then they shot a cloud of arrows at Einar, one of which struck his huge bow as he was drawing it, and it split with a loud report, like the ice cracking in the harbor when the winter ends. King Olaf heard the sound and asked, "What was that which broke just now?" "Your hold on Norway," Einar answered. Then the Earl grappled the Beard and 20 other ships to the Long Serpent, and his men began climbing up the sides in such great numbers that, though many of them were slain, many others managed to reach the deck, and Olaf had too few men left for them to be in all the places where they were needed, while those few were so exhausted that they could scarcely lift their swords to strike. All that remained at last of all the Long Serpent's crew were Olaf and half a dozen of his men. Earl Eric and his Norsemen closed in upon them, and though the defenders fought with greater bravery than ever was seen, even in this battle, they were driven back, step by step. One by one, King Olaf's last warriors were killed, each of them taking many lives before he gave his own. Kolbjorn the Skald died singing a mocking song about how many of them he had killed. "I empty my veins, and so do 50 Danes. My death wound bleeds, and so do 20 Swedes. I end my course, and so do 7 Norse. And then only Olaf was left, with nothing to protect him any longer but his own sword and shield. He still aroused such terror that no one dared come near him. So Earl Eric formed a ring around him, of Danes, Swedes, and his own traitor Norsemen. but Olaf made a rush, cut through them, as if they were grass, and ran to the prow. Then he climbed, as he had once climbed up the Smalzerhorn, up the side of the great gilded serpent's head that formed the ship's stern. There he stood, high above the battle, for all the ships and all the men to see. "Come down and fight," screamed Earl Eric, and his men repeated it, yelping like wolves. "No," answered Olaf. "I still am king, and it is I who call the tune. If you want to fight, you must come up here." He was the only calm man of them all. Eric ordered his bowmen to take aim at the king. "Come down," he ordered him again. "There is a certain snug corner that I've been saving for you, a deep pit under a pigsty." "I know a deeper place than that," replied Olaf, and as the arrows flew up toward him, he put his shield above his head and leapt into the water. They saw where the shield lay floating and surrounded it with small boats, but when they snatched the shield from the waves, Olaf was not under it. They did not know, nor were they able to find out, whether he was drowned or whether he swam underwater a great distance and escaped. He was great in many ways, and swimming was one of them. And there the matter stands. Alive or dead, Olaf has left an uneasy world in his wake. He has lost Norway, and Iceland too, if he ever had it, and whatever else he meant to lay his hands upon. Hakon's son has it now, and he has said he will change everything to what it was before, as if Olaf had never lived. But that he will not achieve. There is one thing he cannot undo, and from that you and I must take heart. Men have tasted what is new. The old will never again satisfy them.